She checked her emails on her phone as she drank a mug of black coffee. With a small stab of dread, she saw one from her lawyer titled Mediation. Opening it, she saw that an actual date was being proposed. Wednesday, March the 19th, over a month away. She pictured Matthew talking to his own lawyer, consulting his diary, asserting his power, as ever. I'm tied up for the whole of next month. Then she imagined facing him across a boardroom table, their lawyers beside them, and felt panic mixed with rage. "You should eat breakfast," said Max, still reading cookbooks. "I'll get something later," said Robin, closing her email. She picked up the coat she'd left draped over the arm of the sofa and said, "Max, you haven't forgotten my brother and his friend are spending the weekend, have you? I doubt they'll be around much. It's just a base." "No, no, all good," said Max vaguely, lost in recipes. Robin headed out into the cool, damp early morning, getting all the way to the tube before she realized that she didn't have her purse on her. Shit. Robin was usually tidy, efficient, and organized. She rarely made this kind of mistake. Hair flying, she ran back to the flat, asking herself what the hell she could have done with it, and wondering, now panicking, whether she'd dropped it in the street or had it stolen out of her bag. Meanwhile, in Denmark Street, the groggy strike was hopping on his one foot out of the shower, eyes puffy and similarly exhausted. The after-effects of a week spent covering Barclays and Hutchins' shifts were now catching up with him, and he slightly regretted having asked Robin to come into work so early. However, just after pulling on his trousers, his mobile rang, and with a stab of fear, he saw Ted and Joan's number.
"Ted?"
"Hi, Corm. There is no need to panic now," said Ted. "I just wanted to give you an update."
"Go on," said Strike, standing bare-chested and frozen in the cold grey light, filtered by the two thin curtains of his attic flat.
"She's not looking too clever. Carenza was talking about trying to get her to hospital, but Joni doesn't want to go. She's still in bed. She didn't get up yesterday," said Ted, his voice cracking. "Couldn't manage it."
"Shit," muttered Strike, sinking down onto his bed.
"Right, Ted, I'm coming." "You can't," said his uncle. "We're surrounded by flood water. It's dangerous. People are telling everyone to stay put, not to travel. Carenza can't. She says she can manage her pain at home. She's got drugs they can inject, because she's not eating a lot now. Carenza doesn't think it's, you know, she thinks it'll be..."
He began to cry in earnest.
"Not immediate, but, she says, not long."
"I'm coming," said Strike firmly. "Does Lucy know how bad Joan is?"
"I called you first," said Ted.
"I'll tell her, don't worry about that. I'll ring you when we put a plan together, all right?" Strike hung up and called Lucy.
"Oh, God, no,"
his sister gasped, when he'd given her an unemotional summary of what Ted had said.
"Stick, I can't leave right now. Greg's stuck in Wales."
"The hell's Greg doing in Wales?"
"It's for work. Oh, God, what are we going to do?"
"When's Greg back?"
"Tomorrow night."
"Then we'll go down Sunday morning."
"How? The trains are all off. The roads are flooded."
"I'll hire a jeep or something. Polwarth will meet us the other end with a boat if we have to. I'll ring you back when I've got things sorted."
Strike dressed, made himself tea and toast, carried them downstairs to the partner's desk in the inner office, and called Ted back, overriding his objections, telling him that, like it or not, he and Lucy were coming on Sunday. He could hear his uncle's yearning for them, his desperate need for company to share the burden of dread and grief. Strike then called Dave Polworth, who thoroughly approved of the plan, and promised to be ready with boat, tow ropes and scuba equipment if necessary.
"I've got fuck all else to do. My place of work's underwater."
Strike called a few car hire companies, finally finding one that had a jeep available. He was giving his credit card details when a text arrived from Robin.
"Really sorry, I lost my purse. Just found it. On my way now."
Strike had entirely forgotten that they were supposed to be catching up on the Bamborough case before the team meeting. Having finished hiring the jeep, he began to assemble the items he'd intended to discuss with Robin. the blood-smeared page he'd cut out of a magus, which he'd now put into a plastic pouch, and the discovery he'd made the previous evening on his computer, which he brought up on his monitor, ready to show her. He then opened up the rotor to check what shifts he'd have to reallocate now that he was heading back to Cornwall, and saw "Dinner with Max" written in for that evening.
"Bollocks," he said.
He didn't suppose he could get out of it now, having agreed to it the previous day, but this was the last thing he needed. At that very moment, Robin, who was climbing the escalator at Tottenham Court Road 2 steps at a time, heard her mobile ringing in her bag.
"Yes," she gasped into the phone, as she emerged into the station, one among many bustling commuters.
"Hey, Robs,"
said her younger brother.
"Hi,"
she said, using her Oyster card at the barrier.
"Everything okay?"
"Yeah, fine," said Jonathan, though he didn't sound quite as cheerful as the last time they'd spoken.
"Listen, is it all right if I bring another guy with me to crash at yours?"
"What?"
said Robin, as she emerged into the blustery rain and controlled chaos of the intersection of Tottenham Court Road and Charing Cross Road, at which there had now been building works for 3.5 years. She hoped she'd misheard what Jonathan had said.
"Another guy," he repeated. "Is that okay? He'll sleep anywhere."
"Oh, John,"
Robin moaned, half jogging along Charing Cross Road now.
"We've only got one sofa bed."
"Kyle will sleep on the floor. He doesn't care," said Jonathan.
"It's not that big a deal, is it? One more person."
"Okay, fine," sighed Robin.
"You're still planning on getting here at 10, though?"
"I'm not sure. We might get an earlier train. We're thinking of skipping lectures."
"Yeah, but the thing is," said Robin, "Cormoran's coming over to dinner to talk to Max."
"Oh, great,"
said Jonathan, sounding slightly more enthusiastic.
"Courtney would love to meet him. She's obsessed with crime."
"No, John, I'm trying to tell you. Max needs to interview Cormoran about a party's playing. I don't think there'll be enough food for another 3.
"Don't worry about that. If we get there earlier, we'll just order ourselves a takeaway."
How was she supposed to say, "Please don't come during dinner"? After he'd hung up, Robin broke into a jog, hoping that Jonathan's time management, which she knew from experience could use improvement, might see him miss enough train south to delay his arrival. Taking the corner into Denmark Street at a run, she saw, with a sinking feeling, Saul Morris ahead of her, walking towards the office and carrying a small, wrapped bunch of pink gerberas.
"They better not be for me."
"Hey, Robs," he said, turning as she ran up behind him. "Oh, dear," he added, grinning. "Someone overslept. Pillow face," he said, pointing at the spot on his cheek where, Robin surmised, her own still bore a faint crease from the way she'd slept, face down and unmoving, because she was so tired.
"For Pat,"
he added, displaying his straight white teeth along with the gerberas.
"Says her husband never gets her anything on Valentine's."
"God, you're smarmy," Robin thought, as she unlocked the door. She noticed that he was calling her Robs again, yet another sign that his discomfort in her presence post-Christmas had evaporated over the succeeding 7 weeks. She wished she could as easily shrug off the lingering, unreasonable, but no less potent sense of shame she felt forever, having seen his erection on her phone. Upstairs, the Harris Strike was checking his watch when his mobile rang. It was unusually early for his old friend Nick Herbert to be calling him, and Strike, now sensitized to expect bad news, picked up with a sense of foreboding.
"All right, Oggy?"
Nick sounded hoarse, as though he'd been shouting.
"I'm fine," said Strike,
who thought he could hear footsteps and voices on the metal stairs outside.
"What's up?"
"Nothing much," said Nick. "Wondered whether you fancied a pint tonight. Just you and me."
"Can't,"
said Strike, very much regretting that this was so.
"Sorry, I've got something on."
"Oh," said Nick. "Okay. What about lunchtime? You free then?"
"Yeah, why not?"
said Strike, after a slight hesitation. God knew he could use a pint away from work, from family, from his 100 other problems. Through the open door he saw Robin enter the outer office, followed by Saul Morris, who was holding a bunch of flowers. He closed the dividing door on them, then his tired brain processed the flowers and the date.
"Hang on. Aren't you busy with Valentine shit?"
he asked Nick.
"Not this year,"
said Nick. There was a short silence. Stryker had always considered Nick and Isla, a gastroenterologist and a lawyer respectively, the happiest couple he knew. Their house on Octavia Street had often been a place of refuge to him.
"I'll explain over a pint," said Nick. "I need one. I'll come to you."
They agreed a pub and a time and rang off. Stryke checked his watch again. He and Robin had 15 minutes left of what he'd hoped would be an hour on Bamborough. Opening the door, he said,
"Ready? We haven't got long."
"Sorry," said Robin, hurrying inside. "You got my text, didn't you, about the purse?"
"Yeah," said Stryke,
closing the door on Morris and pointing at the page from the Magus, which he laid in front of Robin's seat.
"That's the page from the book in the Athorns' house."
He'd called Robin about finding the Athorn straight after leaving the ironmonger, and she'd responded with excitement and congratulations. His present grumpiness aggravated her. Presumably, it was due to her lateness, but was she not allowed a little human fallibility after all the extra hours she'd put in lately, covering her own work and Strike's, managing the subcontractors, trying as hard as she could not to put extra stress on him when his aunt was dying? However, outside she could hear Barclay and Hutchins entering the outer office, which reminded her that not so very long ago she'd been the temp, that Stryke had laid down his expectations of a partner in uncompromising terms at the start of their professional relationship. There were three men outside who undoubtedly considered themselves better qualified for her position than she was. So Robin simply sat down, picked up the page, and read the passage beneath the smear. "The writing mentions blood."
"I know."
"How fresh does blood have to be to analyse?"
"The oldest sample I've heard of that was successfully analysed was 20-something years old," said Stryke. "If this is blood, and it dates from when Gwilhelm Athorn was alive, it's a good decade older. On the other hand, it's been kept away from light and damp inside that book, which might help. Anyway, I'm going to call Roy Phipps and ask him what Margot's blood group was, and then I'll try and find someone to analyse it for us. Might try that bloke your friend Vanessa used to date in forensics. What was his name?"
"Oliver," said Robin. "And he's now her fiancé."
"Well, him, yeah. One other interesting thing came out of my conversation with Sowen."
He told her about Uncle Tudor's belief that Nico and his boys had killed Margot Bamborough.
"Nico? Do you think—" "Niccolò Mucky Ricci, odds on," said Stryke. "He wasn't living far away, and he must have been a local personality, although no one from the practice seems to have realised who'd walked into their Christmas party. I've left a message with the Athorn social worker, because I want to know how much store we can put in Deborah and Sawain's memories. Shanker's supposed to be digging around on Ricci for me, but I've heard sod all from him. Might give him a prod."
He held out his hand, and Robin passed the blood-smeared page back.
"Anyway, the only other development is that I've found C.B. Oakden," said Stryke.
"What? How?"
"Last night," said Stryke, "I was thinking about names. Irene getting them wrong. Douthwaite and Duckworth, Athorn and Applethorpe. Then I started thinking about how people often don't stray too far from their original name if they change it."
He swung his computer monitor around to face her, and Robin saw a picture of a man in early middle age. He was slightly freckled, his eyes fractionally too close together, and his hair thinning, though he still had enough to sweep across his narrow forehead. He was still just recognisable as the boy screwing up his face at the camera at Margot Bamborough's barbecue. The story below read, "Serial swindler gets jail sentence. Despicable betrayal of trust." A serial fraudster who conned over £75,000 from elderly widows over a 2-year period has been jailed for 4 years, 9 months. Bryce Noakes, 49, of Fortune Street, Clerkenwell, who was born Carl Oaken, persuaded a total of 9 vulnerable and trusting women to part with jewellery and cash, which in one case amounted to £30,000 of life savings. Noakes was described by Lord Justice McCreef as a cunning and unscrupulous man who capitalised shamelessly on his victim's vulnerability. Smartly dressed and well-spoken, Noakes targeted widows living alone, usually offering valuations on jewellery. Noakes persuaded his victims to allow him to remove valuable items from their houses, promising to return with an expert assessment. On other occasions, he posed as a representative from the council, who claimed that the householder was in arrears with council tax and about to be prosecuted. Using plausible but entirely fraudulent paperwork, you pressured and bullied vulnerable women into transferring money into an account set up for your own benefit, said Lord Justice Macreath while sentencing. Some of the women concerned were initially too embarrassed to tell their families that they'd let this individual into their homes, said Chief Inspector Grant. We believe there may be many more victims who are too ashamed to admit that they've been defrauded, and we would urge them, if they recognize Noakes's picture, to contact us. The papers misspelled his real name, said Robin. They've printed Oaken, not Oakden.
Which is why he wouldn't have shown up on a basic Google search, said Strike.
Feeling subtly criticized, because she was the one who was supposed to be looking for Oakden, Robin glanced at the date on the news story, which was 5 years old. He'll be out of jail by now.
He is, said Strike,
turning the monitor back towards himself, typing another couple of words and turning it to face Robin again.
I did a bit more searching on variations of his name, and...
She saw an author page of the Amazon website listing the books written by an author called Carl O. Bryce. The photograph showed the same man from the newspaper, a little older, a little balder, a little more creased around the eyes. His thumbs hooked in his jeans pockets, he wore a black T-shirt with a white logo on it, a clenched fist inside the Mars symbol. Carl O. Bryce. Carl O. Bryce is a life coach, entrepreneur, and award-winning writer on men's issues, including masculism, father's rights, gynocentrism, men's mental health, female privilege, and toxic feminism. Carl's personal experience of the gynocentric family court system, cultural misandry, and male exploitation give him the tools and skills to guide men from all walks of life to healthier, happier lives. In his award-winning book series, Carl examines the catastrophic impact that modern feminism has had on freedom of speech, the workplace, men's rights, and the nuclear family. Robin glanced down the list of books beneath the author biography. The covers were cheap and amateurish. All featured pictures of women in various slightly pornified costumes and poses. A scantily dressed blonde wearing a crown was sitting on a throne for From Courtly Love to Family Courts, A History of Gynocentrism, whereas a brunette, dressed in a rubber stormtrooper outfit, pointed at the camera for Shamed, The Modern War on Masculinity.
He's got his own website, said Strike, turning the monitor back to himself. He self-publishes books, offers to coach men on how to get access to their kids, and flogs protein shakes and vitamins. I don't think he'll pass up the chance to talk to us. He seems the type to come running at the sniff of notoriety or money. Speaking of which, said Strike, how are you getting on with that woman who thinks she saw Margot at the window on?
Amanda Laws, said Robin. Well, I went back to her offering her expenses, if she'll come into the office, and she hasn't answered yet.
Well, chase her, said Strike. You realize we're now 6 months in?
Yes, I do realize that, said Robin, unable to help herself. I learned counting at school.
Strike raised his eyebrows. Sorry,
she muttered. I'm just tired.
Well, so am I. But I'm also mindful of the fact we still haven't traced some fairly important people yet. Satchwell, for instance.
I'm working on him, said Robin, glancing at her watch and getting to her feet. I think they're all out there waiting for us.
Why's Morris brought flowers? Said Strike.
They're for Pat, for Valentine's Day.
Why the hell?
Robin paused at the door, looking back at Strike. Isn't it obvious? She let herself out of the room, leaving Strike to frown after her, wondering what was obvious. He can imagine only two reasons to buy a woman flowers: because you were hoping to sleep with her, or to avoid being criticized for not buying flowers on a day when flowers might be expected. Neither seemed to apply in this case. The team was sitting in a cramped circle outside, Hutchins and Barclay on the fake leather sofa, Morris on one of the fold-up plastic chairs that had been bought when the team outgrew the existing seats, and Pat on her own wheeled desk chair, which left another two uncomfortable plastic chairs for the partners. Robin noticed how all three men stopped talking when Strike emerged from the inner office. When she'd led the meeting alone, she'd had to wait until Hutchins and Morris finished discussing a mutual police acquaintance who'd been caught taking bribes. The bright pink daisy-like gerberas sat in a small vase on Pat's desk now. Strike glanced at them before saying,
"All right, let's start with Shifty. Morris, did you get anywhere with that bloke in the tracksuit?"
"Yeah, I did," said Morris, consulting his notes. "His name's Barry Fisher. He's divorced with one kid, and he's a manager at Shifty's gym."
Appreciative, low-toned growls of approval and interest issued from Strike, Barclay, and Hutchins. Robin contented herself with a slight eyebrow raise. It was her experience that the slightest hint of warmth or approval from her was interpreted by Morris as an invitation to flirtation.
"So, I put myself in for a trial session with one of their trainers," said Morris.
"Bet it's with a woman," thought Robin.
"While I was talking to her, I saw him wandering about talking to some of the other girls. He's definitely hetero, judging by how he was looking at one of the women on the cross-trainer. I'm going back Monday for a workout, if that's all right with you, boss. Try and find out more about him."
"Fine," said Strike. "Well, this looks like our first solid lead. A link between Shifty and whatever's going on inside Eleanor Dean's house."
Robin, who'd spent the night before last sitting in a Land Rover outside Eleanor's house, said, "It might not be relevant, but Eleanor took an Amazon delivery yesterday morning. Two massive boxes. They look quite light, but..."
"We should open a book," Morris told Strike, talking over Robin. 20 on dominatrix."
"Never seen the appeal in being whipped," said Barclay thoughtfully. "If I want pain, I just forget to put the bins out."
"Bit mumsy-looking, though, isn't she?" said Hutchins. "If I had SB's money, I'd go for something a bit more..."
He sketched a slimmer figure in mid-air. Morris laughed.
"Ach, there's no accounting for taste," said Barclay. "Army mate of mine wouldn't look at anything under 13 stone. We used to call him the pork whisperer."
The men laughed. Robin smiled, mainly because Barclay was looking at her, and she liked Barclay. But she felt too tired and demoralized to be truly amused. Pat was wearing a boys-will-be-boys expression of bored tolerance.
"Unfortunately, I've got to go back to Cornwall on Sunday," said Strike. "Which I appreciate..."
"The fuck are you going to get to Cornwall?"
asked Barclay, as the office windows shook with the wind.
"Jeep," said Strike. "My aunt's dying. Looks like she's got days."
Robin looked at Strike, startled.
"I appreciate that leaves us stretched," Strike continued, matter-of-factly, "but it can't be helped. I think it's worth continuing to keep an eye on SB himself. Morris'll do some digging with this bloke at the gym, and the rest of you can divvy up shifts on Eleanor Dean. Unless anyone's got anything to add," said Strike, pausing for comments.
The men all shook their heads, and Robin, too tired to mention the Amazon boxes again, remained silent.
"Let's have a look at postcard."
"I've got news," said Barclay laconically. "She's back at work. I've talked to her. Your woman," he added to Robin. "Short, big round glasses, ambled over and started asking questions."
"What about?" asked Morris, a smirk playing around his lips. "Light effects in the landscapes of James Duffield Harding," said Barclay.
"What do you think I asked? Who she fancy for the Champions League?"
Strike laughed, and so did Robin this time, glad to see Morris looking foolish.
"Yeah, I'd read the notice by his portrait and looked him up on my phone round the corner," said Barclay. "Wanted a way of getting onto the subject of weather with her. Anyway," said the Glaswegian, "couple of minutes into the conversation, talking light effects and brooding skies and that, she brought up our weatherman friend. Turned pink when she mentioned him. Said he described a view as picture as turner-esque last week." "It's her," said Barclay, addressing Robin. "She wanted to mention him for the pleasure of saying his name. She's postcard."
"Bloody well done," Strike told Barclay.
"It's Robin's win," said Barclay. "She made the pass, I just tapped it in."
"Thanks, Sam," said Robin pointedly, not looking at Strike, who registered both the tone and her expression.
"Fair point," said Strike. "Well done, both of you."
Aware that he'd been short with Robin during their meeting about the Bamborough case, Strike sought to make amends by asking her opinion on which of the waiting list clients they ought to contact, now that the postcard case was as good as wrapped up. And she said she thought the commodities broker, who thought her husband was sleeping with their nanny.
"Great," said Strike. "Pat, can you get in touch and tell her we're ready to roll if she still wants him under surveillance? If nobody's got anything else..."
"I have," said Hutchins, generally the quietest person in the agency. "It's about that roll of film you wanted passed to the Met."
"Oh, yeah," said Strike. "Is there news?"
"My mate rang last night. There's nothing to be done with it. You won't get any prosecutions now."
"Why not?" said Robin.
She sounded angrier than she'd meant to. The men all looked at her.
"Perpetrator's face is all hidden," said Hutchins. "That arm that appears for a moment. You can't build a prosecution case on an out-of-focus ring."
"I thought your contact said the roll had come out of a raid on one of Mucky Reach's brothels," said Robin.
"He thinks it did," Hutchins corrected her.
"You won't get DNA evidence off a can that old, that's been kept in a shed and an attic and handled by 100 people.
It's a no-go. Shame," he said indifferently. "But there you are."
Strike now heard his mobile ringing back on the partner's desk where he'd left it. Worried it might be Ted, he excused himself from the meeting and retreated into the inner office, closing the door behind him. There was no caller ID on the number ringing his mobile.
"Cormoran Strike?" "Hello, Cormoran,"
said an unfamiliar, husky voice.
"It's Johnny."
There was a brief silence.
"Your father," Rokeby added.
Strike, whose tired mind was full of Joan, of the agency's three open cases, of guilt about being grumpy with his partner, and the logistical demands he was placing on his employees by disappearing to Cornwall again, said nothing at all. Through the dividing door, he could hear the team still discussing the role of film.
"Wanted a chat," said Rokeby. "Is that all right?"
Strike felt suddenly disembodied, completely detached from everything, from the office, from his fatigue, from the concerns that had seemed all important just seconds ago. It was as though he and his father's voice existed alone, and nothing else was fully real, except Strike's adrenaline and a primal desire to leave a mark that Rokeby wouldn't quickly forget.
"I'm listening," he said.
Another silence.
"Look," said Rokeby, sounding slightly uneasy. "I don't want to do this by phone. Let's meet. It's been too fucking long. Water under the bridge. Let's meet, let's... I want to... This can't go on. This fucking feud, or whatever it is."
Strike said nothing.
"Come to the house," said Rokeby. "Come over, let's talk, and you're not a kid anymore. There are two sides to every story. Nothing's black and white."
He paused. Strike still said nothing.
"I'm proud of you, do you know that?" said Rokeby. "I'm really fucking proud of you. What you've done and..."
The sentence petered out. Strike stared motionless at the blank wall in front of him. Beyond the partition wall, Pat was laughing at something Morris had said.
"Look,"
repeated Rokeby, with just a tiny hint of temper now, because he was a man used to getting his own way.
"I get it, I do. But what the fuck can I do? I can't time travel. Al's told me what you've been saying, and there's a bunch of stuff you don't know, about your mother and all her fucking men. If you just come over, we can have a drink, we can have it all out. And," said Rokeby,
quietly insinuating,
"maybe I can help you out a bit. Maybe there's something you want I can help out with. Peace offering. I'm open to suggestions."
In the outer office, Hutchins and Barclay were taking their leave, ready to get back to their separate jobs. Robin was thinking only about how much she wanted to go home. She was supposed to have the rest of the day off, but Morris was hanging around, and she was sure he was waiting because he wanted to walk with her to the tube. Pretending to have paperwork to look at, she was rifling through a filing cabinet while Morris and Pat chatted, hoping he'd leave. She'd just opened an old file on a prolific adulterer when Strike's voice filled the room from the inner office. She, Pat, and Morris turned their heads. Several pages of file Robin was balancing on top of the drawer slid to the floor,
So go fuck yourself!
Before Robin could exchange looks with Morris or Pat, the dividing door between inner and outer offices opened. Strike looked alarming, white, livid, his breath coming fast. He stormed through the outer office, grabbed his coat, and could be heard heading down the metal staircase outside. Robin picked up the fallen pages.
Shit, said Morris, grinning. Wouldn't have wanted to be on the end of that call.
Nasty temper, said Pat, who looked weirdly satisfied. Knew it. The moment I laid eyes on him.
Chapter 40 Thus as they words amongst them multiply, they fall to strokes, the fruit of too much talk. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. Robin found no polite way of avoiding walking to the tube with Morris, and in consequence was obliged to listen to two off-colour jokes and to lie about her Valentine's plans, because she could just imagine Morris's response if she told him Strike was coming over. Pretending she hadn't heard or registered Morris's suggestion that they should get together one night to compare notes on lawyers, she parted from him at the bottom of the escalator with relief. Tired and mildly depressed, Robin's thoughts lingered on Morris as the tube sped her back towards Earl's Court. Was he so used to women responding readily to his undeniable handsomeness that he took it for granted he was eliciting a positive response? Or did the fault lie in Robin herself, who, for the sake of politeness, for the cohesion of the team, because she didn't want to make trouble when the agency was so busy, continued to smile at his stupid jokes and chose not to say, loudly and clearly, I don't like you, we're never going to date. She arrived home to find the flat full of the cheering and delicious smell of simmering beef and red wine. Max appeared to have gone out, but a casserole was sitting in the oven, and Wolfgang was lying as close to the hot door as he could manage without burning himself, reminding Robin of fans who camped out overnight in hope of catching a glimpse of pop stars. Instead of lying down on her bed and trying to get a few hours' sleep before dinner, Robin, who'd been stung by Strike's reminders that she hadn't chased up Amanda Laws or found Paul Satchwell, made herself more coffee, opened her laptop, and sat down at the small dining table. After sending Amanda Laws another email, she opened Google. When she did so, each letter of the logo turned one by one into a pastel-coloured, heart-shaped candy with a slogan on it. Mr. Right, Puppy Love, and Blind Date. And for some reason, her thoughts moved to Charlotte Campbell. It would, of course, be very difficult for a married woman to meet her lover tonight. And who, she wondered, had Strike been telling to fuck off over the phone? Robin set to work on Satchwell, trying to emulate Strike's success in finding C.B. Oakden. She played around with Satchwell's three names, reversing Paul and Leonard, trying initials and deliberate misspellings. But the men who appeared in answer to her searches didn't look promising. Was it possible that Margot's tight-jeaned, hairy-chested artist had turned, over the space of four decades, into classic car collector Leo Satchwell, a rotund man with a goatee who wore tinted glasses? Unlikely, Robin decided, after wasting 10 minutes on Leo. Judging by the photographs on his Facebook page, in which he stood alongside other enthusiasts, he was barely 5 feet tall. There was a Brian Satchwell in Newport, but he had a lazy eye and was 5 years too young, and a Colin Satchwell in Eastbourne, who ran an antiques business. She was still trying to find an image of Colin when she heard the front door open. A few minutes later, Max walked into the kitchen with a bag of shopping in his hand.
"How's the casserole doing?" he asked.
"Great,"
said Robin, who hadn't checked it.
"Get out of the way, Wolfgang, unless you want to be burned,"
said Max, as he opened the oven door. To Robin's relief, the casserole appeared to be doing well, and Max shut the door again. Robin closed her laptop. A feeling that it was rude to sit typing while someone else was cooking in her vicinity persisted from the days when she'd lived with a husband who'd always resented her bringing work home.
"Max, I'm really sorry about this, but my brother's bringing another friend with him tonight."
"That's fine," said Max, unpacking his shopping. "And they might be arriving early. They aren't expecting to eat with us.
They're welcome,"
This casserole serves 8. I was going to freeze the rest, but we can eat the lot tonight. I don't mind.
That's really nice of you, said Robin. But I know you want to talk to Cormoran alone, so I could take them.
No, the more the merrier, said Max, who seemed mildly cheerful at the prospect of company.
I told you, I've decided to give up the recluse life.
Oh, said Robin.
Okay, then.
She had some misgivings about what she feared might be quite an ill-assorted group, but telling herself her tiredness was making her pessimistic, she retired to her bedroom, where she spent the rest of the afternoon trying to find a photograph of Colin Satchwell. Finally, at 6 o'clock, after a great deal of cross-referencing, she located a picture on the website of a local church, where he appeared to be an alderman. Portly, with a low hairline, he in no way resembled the artist she sought. Aware that she really ought to change and go upstairs to help Max, she was on the point of closing her laptop when a new email arrived. The subject line was one word, Creed, and with a spurt of nervous excitement, Robin opened it.
Hi, Robin. Quick update. I've passed the Creed request to the 2 people I mentioned. My Ministry of Justice contact was a bit more hopeful than I thought he'd be. This is confidential, but another family's been lobbying for Creed to be interviewed again. Their daughter was never found, but they've always believed a pendant in Creed's house belonged to her. My contact thinks something might be achievable if the Bamborough family joined forces with the Tuckers. I don't know whether Cormoran would be allowed to conduct the interview, though. That decision would be taken by the Broadmoor authorities, the Ministry of Justice, and the Home Office, and my MOJ contact thinks it's more likely to be police. I'll let you know what's going on as soon as I hear anything else. Best, Izzy. Robin read this email through and allowed herself a flicker of optimism, though she didn't intend to tell Strike what she was up to just yet. With luck, they'd be allowed to talk to the police interviewer before he or she went into Broadmoor. She typed an email of thanks, then began to get ready for dinner. Her slightly improved mood survived looking in the mirror and seeing how tired she looked, with grey shadows under her slightly bloodshot eyes, and hair that definitely needed washing. Making do with dry shampoo, Robin tied back her hair, changed into clean jeans and her favourite top, applied under-eye concealer, and was on the point of leaving her room when her mobile rang. Afraid that it would be Strike cancelling, she was positively relieved to see Isla's name.
Hi, Isla.
Hi, Robin. Are you with Corm?
No, said Robin.
Instead of leaving her bedroom, she sat back down on the bed.
Are you okay?
Isla sounded odd, weak and numb.
Do you know where Corm is?
No, but he should be here in 10 minutes.
Do you want me to give him a message?
No, I...
Do you know whether he's been with Nick today?
No, said Robin, now worried.
What's going on, Isla? You sound terrible.
Then she remembered that it was Valentine's Day, and registered the fact that Isla didn't know where her husband was. Something more than worry overtook Robin. It was fear. Nick and Isla were the happiest couple she knew. The 5 weeks she'd lived with them after leaving Matthew had restored some of Robin's battered faith in marriage. They couldn't split up. Not Nick and Isla.
It's nothing, said Isla.
Tell me, Robin insisted.
What?
Wrenching sobs issued through the phone.
Isla, what's happened? I miscarried.
Oh, God, gasped Robin.
Oh, no, Isla, I'm so sorry.
She knew that Nick and Isla had been trying for some years to have a child. Nick never talked about it, and Isla only rarely. Robin had had no idea she was pregnant. She suddenly remembered Isla not drinking on the night of her birthday.
It happened in the supermarket.
Oh, no, whispered Robin.
Oh, God. I started bleeding at court. We're in the middle of a massive case. I couldn't leave,
said Isla.
And then heading home.
She became incoherent. Tears started in Robin's eyes as she sat with the phone clamped to her ear.
Knew something bad, so I got out of the cab and I went into the supermarket and I was in the loo and I felt, and then a little blob, a tiny body.
Robin put her face in her hands.
And I didn't know what to do, but there was a woman in the loo with, and she, it had happened to her. So kind.
She dissolved again into incoherence. Snorts, gulps, and hiccups filled Robin's ear before words became intelligible again.
And Nick said it was my fault. Said, oh, my fault, working too hard. I didn't take enough care and put the baby first.
He didn't, said Robin. She liked Nick. She couldn't believe he'd have said such a thing to his wife.
He did. He said I should have come home that I put work before the baby.
Isla, listen to me, said Robin. If you got pregnant once, you can get pregnant again.
No, 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 I can't,
said Isla, dissolving again into tears.
It was our third go at IVF. We agreed, no more after this, no more.
The doorbell rang.
Isla, I've got to get the door, it might be Cormoran. Yes, yes, go. It's fine. It's all fine.
Before Robin could stop her, Isla had hung up. Hardly knowing what she was doing, Robin ran downstairs and flung open the door. But naturally, it wasn't Strike. He'd never arrived on time for any out-of-work event to which she'd invited him, whether drinks, housewarming party, or even her wedding. Instead, she found herself facing Jonathan, the brother who most resembled her, tall and slender, with the same strawberry blonde hair and blue eyes. The resemblance was even closer this evening, because both siblings looked peaky. Jonathan, too, had shadows under his eyes, not to mention a slightly grey cast to his skin.
"Hey, Robs."
"Hi," said Robin, accepting Jonathan's hug and trying to act pleased to see him.
"Come in."
"This is Courtney," said Jonathan, "and that's Kyle."
"Hiya,"
giggled Courtney, who was holding a can. She was an exquisitely pretty girl with large dark eyes and long black hair, and she seemed slightly tipsy. Kyle, who accidentally bashed Robin with his large rucksack on entering, was a couple of inches taller than she was, skinny, with a high fade haircut, large bloodshot eyes, and a neatly groomed beard.
"Hi there,"
he said, holding out his hand and smiling down at Robin. A stranger might have thought he was welcoming her to his flat rather than the other way round.
"Robin, yeah?"
"Yes," said Robin, forcing a smile. "Lovely to meet you. Come upstairs. We're eating on the top floor." Lost in thoughts of Isla, she followed the three students. Courtney and Kyle were giggling and whispering together, Courtney a little clumsy on her feet. On reaching the living area, Robin introduced all three guests to Max, while Kyle dumped his none-too-clean rucksack on their host's cream sofa.
"Thanks very much for letting us stay," said Jonathan to Max, who'd laid the table for six. "Something smells really good."
"I'm vegan," piped up Courtney, "but I can just eat, like, pasta, or whatever."
"I'll do some pasta, don't you worry about that," Robin told Max hastily, as she surreptitiously lifted Kyle's dirty rucksack off the sofa, trying not to make a big deal of what she was doing. Courtney promptly knelt on the sofa with her damp trainers still on, and said to Robin,
"Is this a sofa bed?"
Robin nodded.
"We'll have to sort out who sleeps where,"
said Courtney, with a glance at Kyle. Robin thought she saw her brother's smile falter.
"Actually, why don't we put all the bags in my bedroom for now?" Robin suggested, as Jonathan swung his holdall onto the sofa too. "And keep this area clear for after dinner."
Neither Courtney nor Kyle showed any inclination to move, so Robin and Jonathan took the bags downstairs together. Once they were in Robin's room, Jonathan took a box of chocolates out of his holdall and gave them to his sister.
"Thanks, John, that's lovely. Do you feel okay? You look a bit pale."
"I was blunted last night. Listen, Robs, don't say anything to Courtney about her being, like, my girlfriend or whatever."
"I wasn't going to."
"Good, because you've split up," Robin suggested sympathetically. "We weren't ever... we hooked up a couple of times," muttered Jonathan, "but I don't know. I think she might be into Kyle now."
Courtney's laugh rang out from the upper floor. With a perfunctory smile at his sister, Jonathan returned to his friends. Robin tried to call Isla back, but her number was engaged. Hoping this meant that she'd located Nick, Robin texted, "Just tried to call you. Please let me know what's going on. I'm worried about you. Robin. Kiss, kiss, kiss." She went back upstairs and started cooking pumpkin ravioli for Courtney. Apparently, sensing that the casserole would soon be leaving the oven, Wolfgang slunk around Max's and Robin's ankles. Checking her watch, Robin noted that Strike was already 15 minutes late. His record was an hour and a half. She tried, without much success, not to feel angry, after the way he treated her for being late this morning. Robin was just draining the ravioli when the doorbell finally rang.
"Do you want me?"
said Max, who was pouring drinks for Jonathan, Courtney and Kyle.
"No, I'll do it," said Robin shortly.
When she opened the door, she knew immediately that Strike, who was peering down at her with unfocused eyes, was drunk.
"Sorry I'm late," he said thickly. "Can I have a pee?"
She stood back to let him pass. He reeked of Doom Bar and cigarettes. Tense as she was, Robin noted that he hadn't thought to bring Max a bottle of anything, in spite of the fact he'd apparently spent all afternoon in the pub. "The bathroom's there," she said, pointing. He disappeared inside. Robin waited on the landing. He seemed to take a very long time. "We're eating up here," she said, when at last he emerged.
"More stairs," mumbled Strike.
When they reached the open-plan living area, he seemed to pull himself together. He shook hands with Max and Jonathan in turn, and said quite coherently that he was pleased to meet them. Courtney temporarily abandoned Kyle and bounced over to say hello to the famous detective, and Strike looked positively enthusiastic as he took in her looks. Suddenly, very conscious of her own washed-out and puffy-eyed appearance, Robin turned back to the kitchen area to put Courtney's ravioli in a bowl for her. Behind her, she heard Courtney saying, "And this is Kyle."
"Oh, yeah, you're the detective," Kyle said, determinedly unimpressed.
Jonathan, Courtney, Kyle and Max already had drinks, so Robin poured herself a large gin and tonic. While she was adding ice, a cheerful Max came back into the kitchen to fetch Strike a beer, then got the casserole out of the oven and onto the table. Wolfgang whined as the object of his devotion was lifted out of his reach. While Max served everyone at the table, Robin set Courtney's ravioli down in front of her.
"Oh, God, no, wait," said Courtney. "Is this vegan? Where's the packet?"
"In the bin," said Courtney, and she got up and walked into the kitchen. Max and Robin were the only two people at the table whose eyes didn't automatically follow Courtney. Robin downed half a gin before picking up her knife and fork.
"No, it's okay," called Courtney from beside the bin. "It's vegan."
"Oh, good," said Robin. To Robin's left, Max began asking Strike's opinion on various aspects of his character's personality and past. Courtney returned to the table and began to wolf down her pasta, drinking and topping up her wine regularly as she went, while telling Jonathan and Kyle her plans about a protest march at university. Robin joined in neither conversation, but ate and drank in silence, one eye on the mobile beside her plate, in case Isla texted or rang back.
"Couldn't happen," Strike was saying. "He wouldn't have been allowed to join up in the first place. Conviction for possession with intent to supply. Total bollocks."
"Really? The writers did quite a lot of research.
Should have known that then."
"So, yeah, basically you dress up in your underwear and short skirts and stuff," Courtney was saying. And when Kyle and John laughed, she said, "Don't! It's serious."
"No, this is useful," said Max, scribbling in a notebook. "So if he'd been in jail before the army, if he'd done more than 30 months, the army wouldn't have taken him."
"I'm not wearing suspenders, Kyle. Anyway, Miranda doesn't want..."
"I don't know how long he's supposed to have done," said Max.
"I'll check. Tell me about drugs in the army. How common?" "So she says, 'Do you not understand how problematic the word slut is, Courtney?' And I'm like, what do you think?"
"What do you think a fucking slut walks for?" said Kyle, talking over Courtney.
He had a deep voice and the air of a young man who was used to being listened to. The screen of Robin's mobile lit up. Isla had texted back. "Excuse me," she muttered, though nobody was paying her any attention, and she headed into the kitchen area to read what Isla had said. "Didn't mean to worry you. Nick home shit-faced. He's been in the pub with Corm. We're talking. He says he didn't mean it the way I took it. What other way was there? Kiss." Robin, who felt entirely on Isla's side, nevertheless texted back, "He's a dickhead, but I know he really loves you. Kiss, kiss, kiss." As she poured herself another double gin and tonic, Max called to her, asking her to bring Strike another beer from the fridge. When Robin set the open bottle down in front of Strike, he didn't thank her, but merely took a long pull on it and raised his voice, because he was having difficulty trying to make himself heard over Kyle and Courtney, whose conversation had now migrated to the unknown Miranda's views on pornography.
"So, I'm like, you do understand that women can actually choose what to do with their own bodies, Morant?" "Oh, shit, sorry."
Courtney's expansive gesture had knocked over her wine glass. Robin jumped up to get the kitchen roll. By the time she got back, Courtney's glass had been refilled by Kyle. Robin mopped up the wine while the two separate conversations grew steadily louder on either side of her, binned the sodden kitchen roll, then sat back down, wishing she could just go to bed.
"Trouble background? That's fucking original. Guess what? Plenty of people join the army because they want to serve, not to escape."
"Pure whorephobia," boomed Kyle. "I suppose she thinks waitresses love every fucking minute of their jobs, does she?
And he can't have been in One Rifles if he's your age. The battalion was only formed. Labour for hire. Where's the fucking difference? I think it was N 2007. And some women enjoy watching porn too."
Courtney's words fell loudly into a temporary lull. Everyone looked round at Courtney, who'd blushed and was giggling with her hand over her mouth.
"It's all right. We're talking feminism," said Kyle with a smirk. "Courtney isn't suggesting, you know, after-dinner entertainment."
"Kyle!"
gasped Courtney, slapping his upper arm and dissolving into further giggles. "Who wants pudding?" Robin asked, standing up to collect the empty plates. Max, too, got to his feet. "I'm sorry, Strike's all pissed," Robin murmured to Max, as she tipped a few uneaten pieces of ravioli into the bin.
"Are you kidding?" said Max with a slight smile. "This is pure gold. My character's an alcoholic."
He'd gone, bearing a homemade cheesecake to the table, before Robin could tell him that Strike didn't usually drink this much. Indeed, this was only the second time she'd ever known him drunk. The first time he'd been sad and quite endearing, but tonight there was a definite undercurrent of aggression. She remembered the shouted, "Go fuck yourself," she'd heard through the office door that afternoon, and again wondered to whom Strike had been talking. Robin followed Max back to the table, carrying a lemon tart and a third large gin and tonic. Kyle was now treating the entire table to his views on pornography. Robin didn't much like the expression on Strike's face. He'd often displayed an instinctive antipathy towards the kind of young man you could least imagine in the army. She trusted he was going to keep his feelings to himself tonight.
"Form of entertainment, just like any other," Kyle was saying, with an expansive gesture.
Fearful of more accidents, Robin discreetly moved the almost empty wine bottle out of hitting range.
"When you look at it objectively, strip it from all the puritanical bullshit."
"Yeah, exactly," said Courtney. "Women have got agency over their own..."
"Movies, gaming. It all stimulates the pleasure centres in your brain," said Kyle,
now pointing at his own immaculately groomed head.
"You could make an argument that movies are emotional pornography. All this moralistic, manufactured outrage about porn."
"I can't eat either of those if they've got dairy in them,"
Courtney whispered to Robin, who pretended she hadn't heard.
"Women want to make a living out of their own bodies. That's the literal definition of female empowerment. And you could argue it has more societal benefit than..." "When I was in Kosovo,"
said Strike unexpectedly, and all three students turned to look at him with startled expressions. Strike paused,
fumbling to get his cigarette out of his pocket.
"Cormoran," said Robin.
"You can't smoke."
"No problem," said Max, getting up. "I'll bring an ashtray."
It took Strike 3 attempts to make his lighter work, and in the meantime, everybody watched him in silence. Without raising his voice, he dominated the room.
"Who'd like cheesecake?"
Robin said into the silence, her voice artificially cheery.
"I can't," said Courtney, with a slight pout. "But I might be able to have the lemon tart if it's..."
"When I was in Kosovo," Strike repeated, exhaling as Mac returned, placed an ashtray in front of him, and sat back down again.
"Cheers. I investigated a porn case. Well, human trafficking. A couple of soldiers had paid for sex with underage girls. They were filmed without their knowledge, and the videos ended up on Pornhub. Case ended up part of an international civilian investigation. Whole load of prepubescent boys and girls had been trafficked into porn. The youngest was 7.
Strike took a large drag of his cigarette, squinting through the smoke at Kyle.
"What societal benefit would you say that had?" he asked.
There was a short, nasty silence in which the three students stared at the detective.
"Well, obviously," said Kyle, with a small half-laugh, that's a completely different thing. Nobody's talking about kids. That's illegal, isn't it?"
"I'm talking about porn industries full of trafficking," said Strike, still watching Kyle through his smoke. "Women and kids from poor countries. One of the little girls in my case was filmed with a plastic bag over her head while a bloke anally raped her."
Out of the corner of her eye, Robin saw Kyle and Courtney throw her darting looks and knew, with an elevator drop in the area of her solar plexus, that her brother must have shared her history with his friends. Max was the only person at the table who seemed entirely relaxed. He was watching Strike with the dispassionate attention of a chemist checking an ongoing experiment.
"The video of that kid was viewed over 100,000 times online," said Strike.
Cigarette jammed in his mouth, he now helped himself to a large piece of cheesecake, effectively demolishing it to get a third of it onto his plate.
"Plenty of pleasure centres stimulated there, eh?" he went on, looking up at Kyle.
"No, but that's completely different, though," said Courtney, rallying to Kyle's defence. "We were talking about women who... It's up to women, grown women, to decide what they want to do with their own bod..."
"Did you cook all this?"
Strike asked Max, through a mouthful of cheesecake. He still had a lit cigarette in his left hand.
"Yes," said Max.
"Bloody good," said Strike.
He turned back to Kyle.
"How many waitresses do you know who got trafficked into it?"
"Well, obviously none, but, I mean, you're bound to have seen that bad stuff, aren't you, being police?
As long as you don't have to see it, all good, eh?"
"Well, if you feel like that," said Kyle, red in the face now, "if you're so against it, you must never have... You've never used porn, then, you don't..."
"If nobody else wants pudding," said Robin loudly, standing up and pointing towards the sofa area,
"shall we have coffee over there?"
Without waiting for an answer, she headed for the kitchen area. Behind her, she heard the scraping of a couple of chairs. After switching on the kettle, she headed downstairs to the bathroom, where after she'd peed, she sat for 5 minutes on the toilet with her face in her hands. Why had Strike turned up drunk? Why did they have to talk about rape and porn? Her attacker had been a voracious consumer of violent pornography, with a particular emphasis on choking, but his internet search history had been deemed inadmissible evidence by the judge. Robin didn't want to know whether Strike used porn. She didn't want to think about trafficked children being filmed, just as she didn't want to remember Morris's dick pic on her phone, or the snuff movie Bill Talbot had stolen. Tired and low, she asked herself why Strike couldn't leave the students alone, if not out of consideration for his host, then for her, his partner. She headed back upstairs. Halfway to the living area, she heard Kyle's heated voice and knew the argument had escalated.
Arriving on the top floor, Robin saw the other five sitting around the coffee table, on which stood a cafetière, a bottle, and the chocolate Jonathan had brought. Strike and Max were both holding glasses of brandy, while Courtney, who was now very obviously drunk, though nowhere near as much as Strike, was nodding along with Kyle's argument, a cup of coffee balanced precariously in her hands. Robin sat back down at the abandoned dining table, away from the rest of the group, took a piece of beef out of the casserole, and fed it to a pathetically grateful Wolfgang.
"The point is to destigmatize and reclaim derogatory language about women," Kyle was saying to Strike. "That's the point. And that'll be achieved by a bunch of fucked nice middle-class girls gone for a walk in their underwear, will it?"
said Strike, his voice thick with alcohol.
"Well, not necessarily under," began Courtney. "It's about ending victim-blaming," said Kyle loudly. "Surely you can..." "And how is it end victim-blaming?" "Well, obviously," said Courtney loudly, "by changing the underlying attitudes. You think rapists will see you all marching along and think, better jack in the raping, do you?"
Courtney and Kyle both began shouting at Strike. Jonathan glanced anxiously at his sister, who felt another of those sickening drops in her stomach.
"It's about destigmatizing. Oh, don't get me wrong. Plenty of men will enjoy watching you all strut past in your bras," said Strike, taking a sloppy gulp of brandy. "And I'm sure you'll look great on Instagram."
"It's not about Instagram," said Courtney, who sounded almost tearful now. "We're making a serious point about..."
"Men who call women sluts, yeah, you said," said Strike, talking over her again. "I'm sure they'll feel properly rebuked watching you prance, boy, in your miniskirt."
"It's not about rebuking," said Kyle.
"You're missing the..." "I'm not missing your super subtle fucking point," snapped Strike. "I'm telling you that in the real world, this fucking whore walk..." "Slut walk," said Kyle and Courtney loudly. "It'll make fuck all difference. The kind of man who calls women sluts and look at your fucking sideshow and think, there go a load of sluts, look. Reclaim fucking language all you fucking like. You don't change your real world attitudes by deciding slurs aren't derogatory."
Wolfgang, who was still quivering at Robin's ankle in the hope of getting more beef, emitted a loud whimper, which made Strike glance around. He saw Robin sitting there, pale and impassive.
"What do you think about all this?"
Strike asked her loudly, waving his glass in the direction of the students so that brandy slopped over the rim onto the carpet. "I think it would be a good idea to change the subject," said Robin, whose heart was beating so fast it hurt.
"Would you go on a fucking whore?"
"I don't know, maybe," said Robin, blood thumping in her ears, wanting only for the conversation to end.
Her rapist had grunted whore over and over again during the attack. If her would-be killer had squeezed her neck for another 30 seconds, it would have been the last word she heard on earth.
"She's being polite," said Strike, turning back to the students. "Talking for women now, are you?" sneered Kyle. "For an actual rape victim," said Courtney.
The room seemed to warp. A clammy silence descended. On the edge of Robin's field of vision, she saw Max turn to look at her. Strike got to his feet at the second attempt. Robin knew he was saying something to her, but it was all noise. Her ears felt full of cotton wool. Strike lurched off towards the door. He was leaving. He bounced off the doorframe and disappeared from sight. Everyone continued to stare at Robin.
"Oh, God, I'm really sorry if I shouldn't have said that,"
whispered Courtney, through the fingers she'd pressed to her mouth. Her eyes were brimming with tears. From downstairs came the sound of the door slamming.
"It's fine,"
said a distant voice that sounded quite like Robin's own.
Excuse me a moment. She got to her feet and followed Strike. Chapter 41. With that they gan their shivering spears to shake, and deadly points at either's breast to bend, forgetful each to have been ever other's friend. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. The dark, unfamiliar road took the exceptionally drunk Strike by surprise. Rain and high winds battered him as he stood, swaying, wondering which direction the tube was. His usually reliable sense of direction was telling him to turn right, so he lurched off that way, searching his pocket for cigarettes as he went, savouring the delicious release of tension and temper he'd just enjoyed. The memory of what had just happened presented itself in a few scattered fragments. Kyle's angry red face. Tosser, fucking students. Max laughing at something Strike had said. Lots of food, even more drink. Rain sparkled in the streetlights and blurred Strike's vision. Objects seemed to shrink and enlarge around him, particularly the parked car that suddenly put itself in his path as he attempted to walk in a straight line down the street. His thick fingers fumbled fruitlessly in his pockets. He couldn't find his cigarettes. That last brandy might have been a mistake. He could still taste it. He didn't like brandy, and he'd had a hell of a lot of doombar with Nick in the pub. It was a mighty effort to walk in these high winds. His glow of well-being was wearing off, but he definitely didn't feel sick, even after all that beef casserole and a sizable bit of cheesecake, though he didn't really want to think about them, nor about the 40 or so cigarettes he'd consumed in the past 24 hours, nor about the brandy he could still taste. Without warning, his stomach contracted. Strike staggered to a gap between two cars, bent double, and vomited as copiously as he'd done at Christmas, over and over, for several minutes, until he was standing with his hands on his knees, still heaving, but bringing nothing else up. Sweaty-faced, he stood up, wiping his mouth on the back of his hand, pistons banging in his head. It was several seconds before he became aware of the pale figure standing watching him, its fair hair blowing wildly in the wind.
What?
Oh, he said, as Robin came into focus.
It's you.
It occurred to him that she might have followed him to bring his forgotten cigarettes, and looked hopefully at her hands, but they were empty. Strike moved away from the puddle of vomit in the gutter and leaned up against another parked car.
I was in the pub with Nick all afternoon, he said thickly,
under the impression that Robin might be concerned about him. Something hard was pressing into his buttock. Now he realized that he did have his cigarettes on him after all, and he was glad of this, because he'd rather taste tobacco than vomit. He tugged the pack out of his back pocket, and after a few false starts, managed to light up. At last, it penetrated his consciousness that Robin's demeanor was unusual. Focusing on her face, he registered it as white and oddly pinched.
What?
What? She repeated. Fucking what? Robin swore far less often than Strike did. The damp night air, which felt icy on Strike's sweaty face, was rapidly sobering him up. Robin appeared to be angry. Angrier, in fact, than he'd ever seen her. But drink was still slowing his reactions, and nothing better occurred to him than to repeat.
What?
You arrive late, she said. Because of course you do. Because when have you ever shown me the common fucking courtesy of turning up on time?
What? Said Strike again.
This time less because he was looking for information than in disbelief. She was the unique woman in his life who'd never tried to change him. This wasn't the Robin he knew. You arrive, rat-assed, because of course you do, because what do I matter? It's only Robin who'll be embarrassed, and my flatmate, and my fam.
He wasn't bothered, Strike managed to say.
His memories of the evening weren't particularly distinct, but he was sure of that, at least. Max hadn't minded him being drunk. Max had given him more booze. Max had laughed at a joke he'd made, which he couldn't now remember. He liked Max. "And then you launch an attack on my guests. And then," said Robin, "you lay me open to having something I wanted to keep private. To keep..." Her eyes were suddenly wet, her fists clenched, her body rigid. "To keep private, banded about in a fucking argument in front of strangers. Did it once occur..."
"Hang on," said Strike.
"I never once occur to you that I might not want rape discussed in front of people I barely know?
I never..."
"Why were you asking me whether I think slut walks are a good idea?"
"Well, obviously, because..."
"Did we need to talk about child rape over dinner?"
"I was making up..."
"And then you walk out and leave me to..."
"Well," said Strike, "by the sounds of it, the sooner I left, the better."
"Better for you," she said, advancing on him, her teeth bared. He'd never seen her like this before. "Because you got to dump all your aggression at my house, then walk out and let me clean up your fucking mess as per usual."
"As per fucking usual?" said Strike, eyebrows raised. "Waiter!"
"Now, I've got to go back in there and make it all right, soothe everyone's feelings."
"No, you haven't," Strike contradicted her. "Go to fucking bed if you..."
"It's what I do!" shouted Robin, thumping herself hard on the sternum with each word. Shocked into silence, Strike stared at her. "Like I remember to say please and thank you to the secretary, when you don't give a toss. Like I excuse your bad moods to other people when they get offended. Like I suck up a ton of shit on your behalf."
"Whoa," said Strike,
pushing himself off the stationary car and looking down at her from his full height.
"Where is all this?
And you can't be fucking bothered with all I do for you to arrive sober for one dinner."
"If you must know,"
said Strike, temper rising anew from the ashes of his previous euphoria.
"I was in the pub with Nick, whose wife just lost their baby,
I know. And what the fuck was he doing in the pub with you, leaving her to..."
"She threw him out," barked Strike. "Did she tell you that? During the great sisterhood grievance meeting? And I'm not going to apologise for wanting some fucking R&R after the week I've just had."
"Whereas I don't need R&R, do I? I haven't forfeited half my annual leave.
How many times have I thanked you for covering for me when I'm in court?"
"So, what was with you being an arsehole to me this morning when I was late for the first fucking time ever?"
"I'd had 3.5 hours sleep."
"You live over the bloody office!"
"Fuck this," said Strike,
throwing his cigarette down. He began to walk away from her, certain now of the direction to the tube, thinking of the things he could have said, that it was guilt about the pressure he was putting on Robin that had kept him in London, when he should be in St. Moore's with his dying aunt. Johnny Rokeby on the phone that morning, and Nick's tears in the pub, and the relief it had been to sit with an old mate and drink, and listen to someone else's troubles instead of fret about his own. "And don't," bellowed Robin from behind him, "buy me any more fucking flowers."
"No danger of that,"
yelled Strike over his shoulder, as he strode away into the darkness. Chapter 42. His late fight with Britomart so sore did him offend, that ride he could not, till his hurts he did amend. Edmund Spenser, The Fairy Queen. When Strike woke on Saturday morning, with a thumping headache and a foul-tasting mouth, it took him a while to piece together exactly what had happened the previous evening. Aside from the memory of vomiting, which he felt he'd done far too much of lately, all he could at first recall were Kyle's bright red face and Robin's pinched white one. But then, slowly, he reconstructed Robin's complaints, arriving late and drunk, being rude to her brother, and upsetting a dinner party by telling a couple of students what he considered home truths about the real world. He also thought there'd been mention of him being insufficiently touchy-feely with staff. Gingerly, he got out of bed and, with the aid of the furniture, hopped his way to the bathroom and then into the shower. As Strike washed, two separate impulses did battle within him. One was the urge to self-justify, which patted him on the back and awarded him a win for what he could remember of his argument with the students. The other was an innate honesty about his motives that forced him to recognize that his instant antagonism to Robin's guests had been rooted in their resemblance to the kinds of people towards whom his mother would have instantly gravitated. Leda Strike's whole life had been a battle against constraint of any kind. Going for a march in her underwear would have seemed to her just one more fabulous blow against limitations. Strike, who never forgot Leda's generous heart or her ineradicable love of the underdog, was nevertheless clear-eyed about the fact her activism had mostly taken the form of enthusiastic exhibitionism. Not for Leda the tedious toil of door-to-door canvassing, the difficult business of compromise, or the painstaking work structural change entailed. Never a deep or critical thinker, she'd been a sucker for what Strike thought of as intellectual charlatans. The basis for her life's philosophy, if such a word could be used for the loose collection of whims and knee-jerk reactions she called beliefs, was that everything, of which the bourgeoisie disapproved, must be good and right. Naturally, she'd have sided with Kyle and Courtney in championing pornography and slut walks, and she'd have seen her son's quibbles as something he must have picked up from her killjoy sister-in-law. While Strike dried himself and put on his prosthesis, moving cautiously in deference to his throbbing head, the idea of phoning Robin occurred, only to be dismissed. His long-established habit, in the aftermath of a row with a woman, was to wait for her to make the next move, which he considered mere common sense. If she apologized, all well and good. If she wanted further discussion, there was a chance she'd be calmer after a spell of reflection. If she was still angry, it was simply masochistic to volunteer for further grief until she came looking for it. While Strike wasn't in principle opposed to offering an unsolicited apology in the event that he felt himself to have been in the wrong, in practice his apologies tended to be delivered late, and only when it became clear that resolution would come no other way. This modus operandi owed much to his experiences with Charlotte. Attempting to make up with Charlotte before every last ounce of her fury had been spent had been like trying to rebuild a house during an earthquake. Sometimes, after he refused to accede to some new demand, usually leaving the army, but sometimes giving up contact with another female friend, or refusing to spend money he didn't have, all of which were seen by Charlotte as proof he didn't love her. Charlotte would walk out, and only after she came back, by which time Strike might well have met or slept with someone else, would the row be discussed. Their arguments had often lasted a week or more. A couple of times, Strike had returned to postings abroad before anything was resolved. Yet, as he ate a much-needed bacon roll, drank coffee, and downed a couple of Nurofen, after he called Ted, heard that Joan was still holding out, and assured him that he and Lucy would be there the following day, while opening a couple of bits of post and ripping up a large gilt-ed invitation to the Deadbeat's 50th anniversary party in May. While food shopping in the everlasting wind and rain, stocking up for what might be a journey of many hours. While he packed clothes for the trip, spoke to Lucy, and checked the weather forecast. His thoughts kept returning to Robin. Gradually, he realized that what was bothering him most was the fact that he'd got used to Robin being on his side, which was one of the main reasons he tended to seek reasons to call her if he was at a loose end or feeling low. Over time, they developed a most soothing and satisfying camaraderie, and Strike hadn't imagined it could be disrupted by what he categorized as a dinner party row. When his phone rang at 4 o'clock in the afternoon, he surprised himself by snatching it up in hopes that it was his partner, only to see yet another unknown number. Wondering whether he was about to hear Rokeby again, or some other unknown blood relative, he answered.
"Strike."
"What?" said a sharp, middle-class female voice.
"Cormoran Strike here. Who's this?"
"Claire Spencer, the Athorn social worker. You left a message for me."
"Oh, yes," said Strike, pulling out a kitchen chair.